Okay.
Good evening.
So, good afternoon. I am Patrick Murphy, a tax policy specialist with the Interpretations and Technical Advice Division of the Department of Revenue. I will be the facilitator for this public meeting. It is 1:03 p.m. on January 19th, 2022. We will now begin the scheduled public meeting for solicitation of comments regarding the proposed language for WAC 458-20-19402 or Rule 19402 titled Single Factor Receipts Apportionment Generally. Precautions to minimize risk given the current COVID-19 pandemic require that this meeting be conducted electronically. We thank you for taking the time to attend and for providing comments. Other persons present for this meeting include Atif Aziz in his role as the Department's Rules Coordinator, Keith Dakis, Management Analyst, who is monitoring our recording equipment this afternoon as this meeting is being recorded, Tina Poli, Policy Project Coordinator with the Interpretations and Technical Advice Division, Greg King, Regional Audit Manager, Carolyn Bishop, Revenue Audit Supervisor, Deborah Kotecki, Revenue Auditor, and Stacy Alseth, Revenue Auditor. Because this meeting is being conducted via teleconference, we do not have parties physically present for the meeting. At this time, and for purposes of the record, we will go through the list of attendees and ask you to identify yourself, who you are representing, and whether you will be providing comments today.
Okay, so I'm going to start with the folks on the phone for 206-302-6200. If you could identify yourself and who, if anyone, you represent. And it looks like you are muted. I believe *6 is what mutes and unmutes on the phone.
Yeah, that's correct, Tina. If you're on the phone, just hit *6.
Shane Griffiths, Moss Adams, no comments.
Thank you, Shane. And then I've got 206-660-3759. Oh, I think you just muted yourself. Would you unmute yourself with *6 and identify yourself? I didn't catch your name, but I did catch you with Starbucks.
Okay, sorry. Sharon Johnston, no comment, with Starbucks.
Thank you, Sharon. And then I have 215-968-1101. You could identify
Louise
yourself.
Sessner.
Go ahead.
Louise Sessner, LCC, no comment.
Thank you. Next we have Adam Klein.
Yep. Adam Klein, Moss Adams, may have comment, provided someone doesn't beat me to the punch.
Thanks, Adam. Zachary Atkins?
Yeah, hi, Zach Atkins with Pillsbury. Likewise, I may have comments depending on the comments that are given before me.
Thanks, Zach. Michelle Basler?
Michelle Basler with KPMG, no comments.
Thank you, Michelle. Bob Heller?
Yeah, Bob Heller with Clark Neuber. I may have comments.
Thanks, Bob. Brian Aragon?
Hi, Brian Aragon with Amazon, and no comments.
Thank you. Caleb Allen?
Yeah, Caleb Allen with KOM Consulting, and I may have comments.
Thanks, Caleb. Carlo Alba?
Carlo Alba with Amazon. No comments.
Darcy
Quaker, representing Ernst & Young, and yes, I have comments.
Thanks, Darcy. Let me make a note here. Next, David Hansen.
Yes, David Hansen with Madison Cook. No comments.
Thank you. Brett Durbin.
Brett Durbin with Lane Powell, and I'll defer to Scott Edwards for comments.
Thanks, Brett. Scott Edwards.
Scott Edwards with Lane Powell. I may have comments.
Thanks, Scott. Elaine Harper.
Elaine Harper with PwC. No comments.
Thanks, Elaine. Grant Shaver.
Grant Shaver, Clark Huber. I may have comments.
Thanks. Ingrid Soydum?
I'm Starbucks. No comments.
Thank you. John Katsandras?
Yeah, John Katsandras, KOM Consulting. No comments planned.
Thank you. Aaron Johnson?
Hello, Aaron Johnson. Lane Powell. No comments at this time.
Thank you. Kathy McIntyre?
Kathy McIntyre with Northwest Partitions, no comments.
Thank you. Stephen King?
Yeah, Steve King, T-Mobile, no planned comments this time, thanks.
Thank you. Lenka Crowder?
Moss Adams, no comments planned, thank you.
Thank you. Mark Hugh?
Mark Hugh PLC, no comments.
Thank you. Matt Graham?
Matt Graham with Moss Adams, no comments.
Rachel Lemieux?
Rachel Lemieux, BDO, reserving comments to make sure I'm not repetitive to other people's comments.
Thanks, Rachel. Rachel Robertson? You might be muted, Rachel Robertson. We can come back. Sarah Correa?
Sarah Correa with Moss Adams, and no comments.
Thank you. Sarah Nickel?
Sarah Nickel, PwC, no comments at this time.
Thank you. Sonia Barker?
Sonia Barker, BDO, I may have comments.
Thank you. Patricia Sparhit?
Patricia Sparhit from Battelle, no comments.
Thank you. Tiffany Lee?
Tiffany Lee, Starbucks, no comment.
Thank you. Tommy Gantz?
Tommy Gantz with Association of Washington Business, and I will have comments.
Thank you, Tommy. Toshio Kuros?
Toshio Kuros, BDO, no comment.
Thank you. Jeffrey Besley?
Yes, Jeff Vesley from Pillsbury, and I may have comments.
Thanks, Jeff. Bradley Williamson?
Brad Williamson, KPMG, no comments.
Thank you. Sushin Zeng?
Shutia from Patel, no comments.
Thank you. And let me look through for some folks who may have joined us partway through. Let's see here. Is there anyone else who hasn't identified themselves?
Tammy, you just had one more enter into the room. Ashley Dorada.
And Ashley, if you could identify yourself and who you represent, if anyone, and whether or not you intend to comment today.
Hello, Ashley Dorada with KPMG, and I don't have any comments today.
Thank you. Anyone else who hasn't identified themselves. I don't think there's anyone else, so back to you, Patrick.
Thank you, Tina. This public meeting is being conducted pursuant to the provisions of Chapter 34.05 RCW, the Administrative Procedure Act. The purpose of this meeting is to solicit comments from the public on possible rulemaking prior to taking action to propose a new rule. This meeting was announced through publication in the State Register as WSR 21-22-032, which was filed with the Code Revisor on October 26, 2021. Copies of the rule are available on our rulemaking website. Please email Keith Dacus at keithd@dor.wa.gov if you'd like to receive a copy of the proposed rule revisions. We emphasize that the rule draft as now written is provided for discussion purposes only. The rule as proposed is written in the legislative drafting style. New language is underlined and language to be deleted is shown by strikeout. We will consider any comments received pertaining to the preliminary rule draft. We appreciate receiving written comments and will evaluate all comments as we proceed with the rulemaking process. You may send written comments to the attention of myself, Patrick Murphy, no later than January 31st, 2022. My email is patrickm@dor.wa.gov. In this manner, the department can fully consider your comments before proceeding with future rulemaking activities. Please note that this will not be your only opportunity to provide written comments. We will update the draft rule and designate an additional public comment period in connection with the public hearing for Rule 19402. We anticipate that this public hearing and comment period will occur later in spring of this year. Now, let me briefly outline the rulemaking process and where we are in respect to this rule. The first step in the process is to file a notice with the Code Revisor to announce a public meeting for solicitation of comments regarding possible adoption of the new rule. The notice, called a Form CR-101, is published in the State Register and announced through mailings to interested persons. The Department previously filed a CR-101 for this rulemaking on July 31, 2017, and held a first public meeting on September 11, 2017. The second public meeting for this rule is today. The next step is to file a notice of proposed rulemaking with the Code Revisor to announce a public hearing on the proposed rule. This notice, called a Form CR-102, is also published in the State Register and announced through mailings to interested persons. The purpose of the hearing is to receive further public comments regarding the proposed adoption of the new rule. All public comments will be fully evaluated as we proceed in the rulemaking process. Any comments received will be included in the permanent rulemaking file kept by the Interpretations and Technical Advice Division. The final step is to adopt the proposed rule. This is not a public process but simply requires that we submit the final draft of the rule to the Code Revisor with the appropriate forms. The revised rule will be effective shortly thereafter and will be published in the Washington State Register. Before opening the meeting for comments, I will briefly outline and discuss a summary of the context surrounding this rulemaking activity, the department's reasons for proposing amendments to the rule, and an overview of the key points in the preliminary rule draft. Since last amending Rule 19402 in 2015, the department has continued to receive public comments requesting additional guidance on Part 3, how to attribute receipts. Most comments are with regard to subsection 303C on services relating to customers' business activities. For instance, stakeholders have requested clarification on when receipts should be attributed to a business customer's market versus another location under subsection 303C. In addition, stakeholders provided comments related to three interim guidance statements involving the application of subsection 303C. These interim guidance statements are attribution of internet advertising receipts, attribution of receipts from a portionable staff augmentation, and attribution of receipts from R&D services. In addition to these comments, the department has received feedback relating to other provisions of the rule more generally. In response to these comments, the department has circulated a preliminary rule draft containing proposed amendments to the rule. Some of these proposed amendments are significant changes to the rule. This preliminary draft removes subsection 303B, services related to tangible personal property. The department anticipates that under this draft, receipts for many services related to tangible personal property may be attributed under subsection 303C, services provided to a customer engaged in business and related to the customer's business activities. The proposed amendments to subsection 303C provide that a customer's related business activities will generally occur in the customer's market or at the customer's business location or locations. The customer's related business activities occur in the customer's market under the proposed draft if the taxpayer service is promoting the customer's products, engaging in or completing the customer's product sales, or establishing or maintaining the customer's market. If none of these three criteria apply, then the customer's related business activities occur at the customer's business location or locations. The framework for determining a customer's business location is similar to that for attributing receipts to a non-business customer's location under subsection 303D. Subsection 304C of the draft contains a number of amendments to existing examples along with new examples. The department intends that these amendments will incorporate the three existing interim guidance involving subsection 303C of the current rule. Finally, this preliminary draft also contains more general revisions to other parts of the rule besides Part 3. We will now proceed to the comment portion of the meeting. Who do we have up first? Tina, do you want to go through the first person on the list?
So I know that Darcy Quaker had some comments she was prepared to give. Go ahead, Darcy.
Sure. Thanks, Tina. Well, I'll kick this off with just an overarching comment that we need to keep our eye on RCW 8204-462, where the legislature very specifically and repeatedly states that essentially the sourcing of the transactions needs to be, quote, reasonably determined by the taxpayer. And I'd like to see that thought carried over into the rule that, again, the legislature said that the taxpayer determines the sourcing reasonably. And I don't see a lot of that coming into the rule, particularly where the Department of Revenue is in this proposed rule under the definition of customer, talking about books and records and determining who is the customer. So that's kind of a separate issue, and I know we'll probably get into a lot about who is the customer. It could be one of several parties in a transaction, which is causing a lot of confusion, as we've seen in the courts. So just to summarize, keep our eye on the statute about the legislature's directive that it is the taxpayer that reasonably determines the sourcing.
Okay, thank you, Darcy. And if you wouldn't mind also just putting that comment in writing and submitting it to me just so we have it in writing, that would also be very much appreciated. Thanks again.
Welcome. Next, we have Tommy Gantz from Association of Washington Businesses.
Hi, good afternoon. After reviewing this rulemaking with our members, our membership has decided that they would like to see additional time to provide input on the rulemaking. They would also request that the department convene a working group to work through these issues because there are significant changes that are needed. And again, just requesting additional time for input as they sort through this. So that's pretty much all my comments on that.
I have a follow-up, Tommy. Did your members have an idea of what kind of time they're thinking about?
Well, I think it would be contingent upon the acceptance of a request for a working group. It would be determined by that. In this instance, I think they've had I think that this, if I remember the dates correctly, was around the 20th of December that there was something put out about this, and it just hasn't been enough time for them. I wasn't given any feedback in respect to the amount of time it would take to sort through it.
Okay. Thanks, Tommy.
Thank you, Tommy.
We had a handful of folks who were tentative about providing comments, and so I'll kind of try and go through those folks to see if they are now interested in providing comments. I'll start with Adam Klein, if you have a comment to share.
Sure. So there may be a potential conflict in the rule between sections 401 and section 301H. And this has to do with attribution of a portion of income from different activities. So, like if a taxpayer performs, say, a marketing service and travel agency services, they might be different apportional activities. Could you have more than one reasonable method to attribute? And it seems like Section 301H kind of gives deference that you generally apply a single attribution, but there may be some exceptions where you have more than one attribution method. Section 401 says taxpayers must calculate a separate receipts factor for each apportional activity, which is the B&O tax classification engaged in. So if you had multiple different activities that were all under, say, service and other, kind of implies there's one attribution method, not more than one. And then example four, it kind of starts to imply that you might have multiple different attribution methods within a single item of apportional income. So I think you could have multiple B&O classifications, multiple apportional activities that way, and then you could have multiple apportional activities within a single B&O tax classification, like within service and other, because you could have different activities the taxpayer performs. It seems like the tenor of the rule is that you could have multiple attribution methods, but it just might be worth spending a little bit of time to look at where those pieces connect and reference each other. And I'll submit written comments to make that more of a robust, clean comment.
Got it. Thank you, Adam. And yeah, thank you also for submitting that in writing so we can take that into consideration.
Welcome.
Next, both Zach Atkins and Jeffrey Vesley from Pillsbury. If either of you were interested in making comments.
Yes, Tina, this is Jeff Vesley. Thank you. I would echo something that Darcy mentioned at the beginning. I think the key thing that we see is I think the keeping an eye on the statute is almost goes without saying here. And that really arises in two places that jump out at us. One is the what the statute does in defining customer. I believe that in looking at the regulation right now, we are going way beyond what the statute actually says is the customer. And I think that that is an issue that needs to be looked at pretty carefully, especially in light of the recent AT&T case where our regulation really should not be in altering or enlarging the statute. And similarly, I think the section of the regulations that actually talk about looking to the market, the customer's market, and trying to figure out whether that is anywhere really in the statute in so many words, I think that is also something that concerns us, whether or not the regulation is really going beyond the terms of the statute. Some of this is in the existing law, in both of those comments, frankly, as well as the changes that are being proposed. And we will put these comments down in writing for you and with more detail for you.
Thank you, Jeff.
Yes. Thank you, Jeff.
Bob Heller with Clark Neuber, did you have any comments you'd like to provide?
Thanks, Tina. I don't have anything further at this time. Thanks.
Okay. Caleb Allen with KOM.
Yeah, thanks, Tina. Hey, Patrick, how you doing?
I'm pretty good, Caleb. How are you?
Pretty good. A couple things. I guess, you guys talked about incorporating the interim guidance, and I've noticed it looks like there's three examples that incorporate the three interim guidance statements. I guess maybe you could speak to whether or not you think those examples incorporated everything, or is there something left out? I guess the heart of that question is, we all sort of know what's in the interim guidance statements, and it looks like they're being incorporated into the rule. And I guess the question is, in your mind, has anything changed with respect to what's in the rule now versus what was in the guidance? So that's my first comment. Stick a pin in that one, and I'll go to the next one if that's all right. That's all right. Okay. The next one is just kind of directionally looking at the section of the rule that addresses attribution through billing addresses, maybe tightening that up a little bit in the sense that it's a little squishy right now. It might be confusing as far as, for example, is it just law firms or consulting firms, or can everybody use it? It uses the phrase thousands of charges, uses the phrase commercially reasonable, uses the word significant. It's a little bit squishy as far as who can use it and what it means. And some people I've talked to have pointed to, I guess the MTC has something out there around what people are calling kind of a safe harbor in this area. And it tightens things up in the sense that it does things like says, any customer with that represents 5% or less of your income would qualify for this treatment. So it kind of tightens up that significant and puts a number on it, 5%. And then I think it also says something like, if you have 250 clients that are essentially similar. So without getting into the detail, and I can provide written comments, I guess the sort of, if I wanted to summarize that, maybe just making that section, that you could call kind of a safe harbor a little bit clearer and tightening it up with some numbers and things that are a little easier to administer both, for the taxpayer and for the department.
Okay, thanks, Caleb. As part of that written comment that you could provide, if you could provide suggestions that you have on both of those areas that you covered, I think that would be much appreciated, and we can consider those.
For sure, on the safe harbor part. Now, on the first one, though, I am kind of looking for feedback from maybe you and Tina on any thoughts you might have around when you incorporated that interim guidance. Is it, in your mind, did it all get put into the rule, in a sense, the principles that are in there, or did some things get left out, or has it changed? Does that make sense, sort of how the incorporation process is going? Did that make sense?
Yes, I think it makes sense, and my general feedback would be that, yes, the rule is intended to incorporate the three interim guidance statements that I addressed kind of up at the top of the meeting, that is R&D services, staff augmentation, and internet advertising. As far as the specific examples that you are addressing, I think I would have to look at the specific examples and get back to you on the specifics of what you're asking, but I can say that at a high level, the rule is, it's in a pre-proposal stage right now, but our intention is that when the rule is finalized, that yes, it will incorporate those interim guidance statements. Anything to add on that, Tina?
I guess maybe to clarify that the rule, once it's finally adopted, would supersede the interim guidance, and so it would only be the rule eventually that would be providing guidance in this area. As far as our frameworks, it really depends on certain circumstances. So there will be a lot of instances where under our current interim guidance and under what is our current proposed rule, the outcome would be the same, but there may be some other circumstances where under our new framework that's proposed in this draft rule, that there might be a different outcome than under the current interim guidance. It really just depends on the specific facts.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I guess that was sort of the detail I was hoping to get, was just what your thoughts are on your intent, how things have changed. So, for example, on the staff augmentation, looking at the example, it looks like that's just really changed a lot. And so that looks like your intent is to maybe not follow the interim guidance on that. That's sort of my read on it right now. And then I was just, you know, looking for, and the internet advertising to me looks pretty much the same. Like it just sort of got brought into the example. And so it's there's a couple of differences, but other than that, and then, you know, on the R&D, you know, there does look like there might be some changes as far as what's in that R&D guidance versus what's being brought in. And so it looks like the department might be shifting on its intent. And that was just that's what I was looking for, was that sort of difference. What, you know, what is your aim? What are you trying to do with this new draft here versus what's in that interim guidance? And so I'll just leave it at that. I don't know if that's helpful or if that's something you're able to comment on, but I'll just leave it there.
I'll give an overarching comment that our purpose with all of this rule update is to get better clarity and consistency overall. So I think that's our main guiding principles there.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks, Caleb. Scott Edwards with Lane Powell, did you... Oh, I'm sorry, we have a comment. Rachel Lemieux, I'll go to you.
Well, thank you so much for that. Yeah, I raised my hand because I wanted to kind of follow up on some of Caleb's questions, specifically as it related to the interim guidance statement and staff augmentation. I'm unclear still about where the department is headed. It looks to me like the department has gotten rid of the concept of being responsible for the outcome of a product before being able to source to the customer's market. Is that correct?
Thank you, Rachel. So I would characterize the proposed draft as when it comes to a service provided by a taxpayer, whether that service is characterized under the current interim guidance as staff augmentation or not, focusing on the specific service that's being provided and incorporating the characterization of that service into the analysis. And so that analysis, I think going back to what Tina said earlier, under the current draft, which is, we're emphasizing still in the pre-proposal stage, but once it is finalized, we'll supersede the current staff augmentation interim guidance, and I think including the analysis piece of the staff augmentation guidance that I think you're referring to.
Okay. Yeah, because I've always been curious as to the, you know, that when you're truly looking at a staffing company and the department's policy as stated in the staffing guide, that you look to the activity of the worker to determine the tax classification that the revenue from the worker needs to be recorded into. And that seemed in direct conflict with what was provided in the interim guidance. And then when I keep that in mind, which apparently has not changed in terms of what's in the staffing industry guide, then I translate this over to the example 22 and 24, I believe, or 22, 23, and 24. I think I'm seeing the department
move more towards how it taxes the staffing industry in terms of looking to the activity of the worker, as opposed to saying that if you provide staffing services, you're providing an HR-related activity. That's really kind of what I'm trying to get at. And if we go back to what someone said earlier, and it may have been Darcy, but performing, putting together work groups, right, to kind of work through some of these things, because this is critically important to understand these different, not only just staffing, but all of the interim guidance statement. And I apologize, I think it was Tommy who said we would really like to have work groups, and I wholeheartedly concur with that.
Okay, thank you, Rachel. And also, if you wouldn't mind, as I've been mentioning to others, just putting that comment about your concerns and questions and anything else you think is worthwhile to provide just in writing, so we can consider that and add it to the rulemaking record. We would very much appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
And for anyone who is identifying areas where there it appears that there is a change or a shift in our structure for certain industries or certain scenarios, we're interested in hearing if you agree with that shift or if you disagree. Those comments would be very appreciated as well. And I think next, Scott Edwards, if you wanted to make comments.
I always want to make comments, but I'd actually like to start by thanking the department for the efforts that you've been engaging in with respect to revising Rule 194.02, and particularly the effort to focus on bringing more clarity and guidance around some aspects of Rule 194.02 that both taxpayers and the department have been having a tremendous amount of difficulty with. So, you know, I want to start by thanking you for that. Excuse me. I do want to echo Tommy's request for additional time to provide comments. The draft rule wasn't circulated until late December, right before the holidays, which in and of itself limits the amount of time available to be able to review it. The revisions are extensive, and while I've spent quite a few hours so far trying to work through the rule, I haven't even gotten through the entire rule yet. So, there's going to be potentially more than what I'm going to try to condense into just a few short things here. So I would appreciate some additional time. I have been a big advocate for a long time of the department providing guidelines for determining where the customer's related business activities occur. Patrick, in setting up the structure here, 303C says that when the service is not related to real or tangible personal property, is provided to a customer that is engaged in business and relates to the customer's business activities, that the benefit is received where the customer's related business activities occur. Currently, the only guidance that exists about that are in examples 16 through 25, I believe it is, which have at least three different substantive types of outcomes with very little way to figure out when any of those different outcomes might apply. And the easiest thing that seems to be pullable out of it is if you label the activity a selling-related activity, then you go to market. But and selling activity seems to be very broad. as reflected in the very first example 16 involving the law firm that defends a manufacturer in a product liability lawsuit, I recognize one of the things that is explicitly getting changed here. I know at one point the department had been explicitly thinking about the revision in the context of defining what a selling related activity was, and I think part of what you've done in the go-to-market piece reflects some of that discussion. One of the aspects that kind of caught me by surprise was the adoption of the nexus, creating or maintaining a market standard, and to me there's some ambiguity about what that means and how it would be applied in the context of evaluating apportionment and where a customer's related business activity occurs. And so while I think the draft rule is moving in the right direction with respect to guidance, I think there's also some maybe new unintended ambiguities that might be being created that there should be some additional thought and work through given, and maybe a couple of short items to illustrate that is if we look at two other of the original examples, and I'm trying to follow my notes here, the debt collector example, which was previously I guess it was previously 17 and would now be 14. But it previously said that debt collector services were sourced to the customer's market because debt collection was a selling activity. And now it says that they're sourced to the market because the service is completing the customer's product sales. And that, I don't think I understood the rationale of how debt collector services would be completing a sale in light of case law explicitly indicating that selling a product and extending credit to the buyer are two different activities. So, that's an area, I think, of ambiguity. While there's been an effort of describing the explanation, it doesn't necessarily make any sense to me. And then the next one that I'll talk about briefly is the call center example, which I believe is on the next page. What was originally example 21 and would now be example 16. And at least as I'm looking at, and it's a little bit hard to read in the PDF with the big draft on it, but it looks like the language of relating to the retailer's selling activity, I can't tell whether that's actually being deleted or put in parentheses now. But then the new explanation talks about may be promoting the retailer's products and establishing or maintaining the market. But the only thing we're told about the service is that the call center is providing customer service. And so, again here, I'm having difficulty connecting the result and the explanation of the result with the rubric that's being presented. And, I'm hopeful that we can continue to have dialogue with the department to try to work through some of this stuff and hopefully help to ensure that, more detailed guidance actually provides greater clarity rather than substituting one set of of ambiguity and dispute for a different category of ambiguity and dispute.
Got it. Thank you, Scott. With regard to the timing, I'll just reiterate that currently our timeline is to extend the current comment period until January 31st, and then as part of the CR102 form, which we'll file in connection with the upcoming public meeting after we're able to incorporate the initial round of comments, we'll plan to reopen for a second comment stage. With that being said, if there are still concerns around that current timeline, please feel free to provide those to us in writing also, and we'll be able to consider those. Then the other piece that I'll just reemphasize is that, yes, some of the changes to the rule are geared towards assisting and trying to clarify and helping the determination of where the customer's related business activity occurs, and that's one of the purposes of the three prongs in subsection 303C under the proposed draft. That's to ask whether the service is promoting the customer's products, engaging in or completing the customer's product sales, and establishing or maintaining the customer's market. If the answer is yes to any of those, the analysis would go in the direction of concluding the related business activity of the customer occurs in the customer's market. If the answer is no, we go down to the business location analysis. But if you have...
Patrick, I do understand that conceptually. I think part of my comment is I think there is ambiguity in the draft rule about what would lead to a yes answer with respect to each of those three different prongs. That's an area where providing some additional clarity in the rule would be tremendously helpful, because as I was trying to point out, some of the examples don't make sense to me as to why that would be the conclusion for one of those categories, in much the same way that the product liability lawsuit thing has never made any sense to me about a selling activity. It's a different example and scenario, but the common theme is greater guidelines to be able to not have a dispute about whether or not you've met the test. Having the test is great, but if the test is ambiguous and the taxpayer and the department are always going to be fighting about whether or not you've met one of the three tests, it's simply shifted the problem rather than solved the problem. And so I think it's certainly moving in the right direction. I think a little bit more refinement and greater clarity can be tremendously helpful.
Got it. As part of your written comment, if you're able to provide us one, if you could include a summary of those areas where you see potential ambiguities and suggestions on how you would go about resolving those from your perspective, we'd be happy to consider those.
Thank you.
Thank you, Scott. Sonia Barker, were you interested in providing comments?
No comments, thank you.
Thanks. And Grant Shaver, I didn't know if you were interested in providing comments or not.
I don't have any comments, thank you.
Oh. Is there anyone else, either who I missed writing down or who now has feeling like they want to share some comments? Open the floor up. Anyone else to share comments today at the public meeting?
Okay, well, hearing no additional comments, I will move forward then with concluding the public meeting. Okay. Well, thank you for participating in this public meeting. This has been the second public meeting for input regarding WAC 458-20-19402, single factor receipts apportionment generally. If you are not on the department's rules notification list, did not receive a notice of today's meeting directly from the department, and you want to be kept informed of future rulemaking activities related to this rule, please provide Keith Dakis with your name, mailing address, and email address. This public meeting is now adjourned. For the record, the time is now 1:53 p.m. Thank you.